Chapter 8. Great Reset of Food. The mainstream media is now warning us that it's time to get ready for food shortages and food rationing. Of course, they're blaming Putin for the food crisis. But you and I know better. We're entering a frontier with threats from many dimensions: inflation, supply chains collapsing, food shortages, fertilizer shortages, and a global energy crisis. This is a global food crisis. It will hit every country in the world. People like me have been warning that it was coming and was being intentionally created dating back to the original COVID lockdowns in March 2020. But this is the frame I want you to put on this issue. Every time one of the globalists tries to implement some part of their plan, such as an attack on our supply chain for food, there are 1,000 people like you and me trying to fix the problem. They may not understand what's happening on the global level, but they know much better than the globalists how to fix things in their small corner of the world. All these tiny victories will lead to a much larger one. Now we're seeing Joe Biden say that food shortages are real. Countries are beginning to restrict exports of their food. In fact, just at the time of writing this chapter, to secure the supply of basic food goods, the government of Moldova banned the exports of grain and sugar effective after March 1, 2022. To prevent market failures, it extended the price regulations from baked goods to other basic goods: pork, frozen fish, poultry, beets, white cabbage, eggs, and pasta. Reuters reported that Hungary followed suit shortly thereafter and banned the export of grains. Hungary is a big producer of grains and a net exporter. So when they ban exports of grains, that means that there are other countries that are net importers who will not have food. Those who have grains are no longer giving it away, and those who don't will soon find themselves in the middle of a dangerous food crisis. This is how the Reuters news agency described the problem in June 2022. Russia and Ukraine together account for nearly a third of global wheat supply, and their importance has been underscored by an Indian export ban as well as adverse crop weather in North America and Western Europe. The war, together with Western sanctions against Russia, have sent the price of grain, cooking oil, fertilizer, and energy soaring. Ukraine is also a major exporter of corn, barley, sunflower oil, and rapeseed oil, while Russia and Belarus, which has backed Moscow in the war and is also under sanctions, account for over 40% of global exports of the crop nutrient potash. It's getting so serious that recently the European Union had a meeting with their agricultural ministers and is enacting an EU food crisis contingency plan, a crisis mechanism to monitor a food shortage. But the truth is that they don't really have a plan. The only plan is to blame climate change, greedy capitalists urge us to stop eating meat, and start tracking our carbon footprints. Of course, they will do all of this while flying on private jets to meet in private to discuss how to save us all. On my daily radio show, I've talked extensively about the United Nations discussing global food rationing. Now, at the time of writing this, it's the year 2022. Joe Biden has said about food shortages, it's going to be real. However, much as I hate to tell you this, it's only the beginning. In April 2022, an article from the Western Standard Online documented the dozens of food facilities that have caught on fire across the United States in spring 2022. The author of the piece, Melanie Risden, wrote beautifully about what's been happening. Food shortages have been exacerbated by a string of fires, plane crashes, and explosions at nearly 24 food processing facilities across Canada and the U.S. The most recent happened on Thursday in Georgia, when a small plane crashed shortly after takeoff into a General Mills plant just east of Atlanta. 2 occupants of the plane were killed in the crash, as reported by the New York Post. A massive fire on Monday night destroyed parts of the Azure Standard headquarters in Oregon, a company that self-describes as the USA's largest independent food distributor. The company said basically any liquid product, such as honey, oil, and vinegar, will be out of stock due to the fire, as reported by Vision Times. The company also said it lost its fruit packing and carob product facility in the blaze, but said the effects will be minimal as fruit harvesting season hasn't started yet. 24 food processing plants across the country have had problems, including one where a plane crashed into the plant. Sounds a little mysterious, don't you think? But again, see how even though this incident happened, those on the ground are figuring a way around the problem. Risden continued. Last Thursday, firefighters contended with a massive blaze at Taylor Farms packaged salad plant in Salinas, California, a key agricultural region 177 kilometers south of San Francisco. The fire broke out late Wednesday night, as reported by KTLA. The same day, an airplane crashed into Idaho's Gem State processing facility, a plant said to process 18,000 acres worth of potatoes each year. The pilot of the plane did not survive. However, no employees were injured, reported Vision Times. On April 13th, firefighters from several departments in Maine helped battle a massive fire that destroyed East Conway Beef and Pork Butcher Shop and Meat Market in Center Conway, New Hampshire. Investigators did not indicate what caused the fire, reported ABC affiliate WMTW in Portland, Maine. Adding to the mix, a suspicious fire and a second airplane crashing into a food processing plant, and you might have something that would draw the attention of Sherlock Holmes. In March, KIAT-TV reported a major fire that forced the closure of the Nestle plant in Jonesboro, Arkansas. The plant makes frozen foods, particularly Hot Pockets. The frozen foods plant announced its plans for a $100 million expansion last year. The Penobscot McCrum Potato Processing Facility in Belfast, Maine, was also destroyed by fire in March. Officials believe a deep fryer was behind the fire, as reported by ABC affiliate WMTW News 8. In Canada, fire crews and paramedics responded after explosion at the Centre de Valorisation de l'Aliment de l'Estrie, an industrial food preparation and processing facility in Sherbrooke, Quebec. 5 people were injured in the March explosion that turned into a major fire. Plane crashes, fires, and explosions. Nothing out of the ordinary to see here. I'm sure it's all a coincidence. No reason to scare the children. And in late March, a fire at the Maricopa Food Pantry, a food bank in Arizona, saw 50,000 pounds worth of food burn up, and yet another blaze at the Texas-based Rio Fresh severely damaged the onion processing facility. In February, a portion of Wisconsin River Meats was destroyed by fire, according to Channel 3000 News. The Mauston-based company said the old portion of its plant was a total loss from the fire. Another fire in February, sparked by a boiler explosion at a potato chip plant south of Hermiston, Oregon, sent several people to hospital with minor injuries. The Shearer's Food Plant, as reported by The Oregonian, supplies much of the western U.S. with potato and corn chips. A third fire in February caused the Louis Dreyfus Company's Claypool, Indiana, soybean processing and biodiesel plant, the largest fully integrated soybean processing plant in the U.S., to suspend production. Thankfully, no injuries were reported. I understand that some people might wonder how this period of time compares to other periods of time. Maybe this is just usual. Maybe this is some kind of cyber warfare being waged by China or Russia. Who would know? If this was sabotage, the entire point would be to do it in a way that did not rouse the American public, right? A blaze in a poultry processing plant in the Hamilton region of Ontario in January caused extensive damage but caused no injuries. The multiple alarm fire, as reported by Global News, will cost millions in repairs. Firefighters responded to a fire in January at the Cargill Nutrina plant in LeConte, Louisiana. The fire took more than 12 hours to put out, as reported by KALB-TV, an NBC-CBS-CW-affiliated television station. A fire in December caused more than $100,000 in damages to a San Antonio food processing plant. KTSA 107.1 reported there were no injuries as a result of the fire. In late November, a fire engulfed the Made Right Steak Company food processing plant in Lackawanna County, Pennsylvania, as reported by ABC affiliate news station WNEP. The cause of the fire was ruled an accident. I understand that when you read the litany of incidents at food processing plants, it's easy to be disheartened. These people seem so powerful. But I'm sure at every one of those plants, the salt of the earth, good American working people are fixing things. They are our greatest weapon, and that should never be forgotten. The article finished up the litany of suspicious incidents. A fire in mid-September at the JBS USA beef processing plant in Grand Island, Nebraska, halted operations in the facility that typically processes about 6,000 head of cattle daily. Although the fire damaged a portion of the facility, the company, at the time, released a statement that said the fire did not impact the primary production area, as reported by Reuters. Another raging fire in August of 2021 severely damaged the Patak Meat Production Company in Austral, Georgia, as reported by Channel 2 Action News in Atlanta. According to the company's customer service department, Patak Meat Production is operating at a much reduced capacity, but hopes to complete repairs in the coming months and will then regain full operational capacity. In July, firefighters battled a large fire at the River Valley Ingredients plant in Hanesville, Alabama. The cause of the fire, as reported at the time by NBC affiliate WVTM-TV, was unknown. Another July fire at the Kellogg factory in Memphis, Tennessee, was determined to be an accident and no injuries were reported. Dozens of crews were called in to help fight the fire due to the brutal heat, reported Fox 13 Memphis. The cause of a fire in April 2021 at the Smithfield Foods plant in Monmouth, Illinois, was unknown, according to WGIL 93.7 FM in Galesburg. As I've stated for many years on my radio show, the global elite's plan is to destabilize the global food supply in order to fully control the population and institute the Great Reset. You can take the succinct summary from Melanie Risden, who documents dozens of food plants that have mysteriously been destroyed, as simply a coincidence. But what we cannot debate is that it's quite peculiar. For the longest time, food prices remained stable in the United States, and consumers were not particularly concerned about price fluctuations each month. As far back as we can remember, our supermarkets were packed with food, and something that always made grocers proud was their ability to ensure an enormous variety for their customers. But now we can see that things are a whole lot different, and not in a good way. As the world tries to rebound from the global recession induced by the COVID lockdowns, a massive wave of inflation has dramatically hitting agricultural commodities, and food producers are having to pass those cost increases to consumers. However, many industry experts have been warning that the recent price hikes won't be the only ones. In fact, they are marking the beginning of a prolonged era of higher prices and low supply. This means that although we are already facing some painful food inflation, prices won't get any lower than they are at this moment for a long, long time. When we look forward, several events that are unfolding right now will likely combine and contribute to the acceleration of food price inflation in the coming months. In addition to the curious accidents at food production facilities, gas prices are hitting record highs every month and has become way more expensive to transport food around the country. Supply transportation costs have already been going up due to a national shortage of drivers. As CNN reported on May 30th, 2022, just as the summer driving season was getting started, the national average of regular gasoline rose to a fresh record of $4.62 a gallon on Monday, according to AAA. That's up a penny from Sunday and 44 cents more expensive than a month ago. Gas prices are up sharply from last Memorial Day, when they averaged $3.05 a gallon, according to AAA. 7 states are now averaging $5 a gallon gas, with the latest being Illinois, rounded up from $4.996. New York and Arizona are just pennies away from hitting that milestone, and there are no states where gas prices average less than $4.10 a gallon. As a consequence, companies will have no choice but to pass these added costs on to consumers. Not to mention the ruthless mega drought in the western states just continues to get worse. Many areas haven't experienced such an extreme drought in more than 20 years, going back to 2000. In many states, water levels are dropping dangerously low, and Smithsonian Magazine reports the Colorado River Basin is experiencing a 1,200-year mega drought. Furthermore, the shipping and supply chain issues are not going away. Ryan Johnson, a 20-year veteran in the trucking industry, revealed in a recent article published by Medium, "I have a simple question for every expert who thinks they understand the root causes of the shipping crisis. Why is there only one crane for every 50 to 100 trucks at every port in America? No expert will answer this question. I'm a Class A truck driver with experience in nearly every aspect of freight. My experience in the trucking industry of 20 years tells me that nothing is going to change in the shipping industry." The trucking industry veteran pointed out that one of the main reasons why most trucking companies don't want anything to do with transporting shipping containers is the fact that port operations have always been extremely messy and things have gotten a whole lot worse since the beginning of the COVID lockdowns. "I've waited up to 8 hours in the first line just to get into the port. It's a rare day when a driver gets in and out in under 2 hours. By rare day, I mean maybe a handful of times a year," Johnson explains. "Ports don't have enough workers to keep operations fluid, no matter whether you're in a coastal or inland, union or non-union port. The situation is the same all over the nation." Johnson, for his part, is a union driver paid by the hour. However, most port drivers are independent contractors leased onto a carrier who's paying them by the load. That means whether their load takes 2 hours, 14 hours, or 3 days to complete, they get paid the same rate. On top of that, they have to pay at least 90% of their truck operating expenses, and companies usually cover less than 10% of the remaining expenses. In short, non-union drivers are paid extremely low rates for ship and container transport, and they have to cover all their own repairs and fuel and all truck-related expenses. Johnson reveals, "I honestly don't understand how many of them can even afford to show up for work. In some cases, they work 70-hour weeks and they still end up owing money to their carrier. That's why when ports started to get congested, due to the impacts of the health crisis last spring, the vast majority of drivers refused to show up. In a few weeks, congestion got so bad that of being able to do 3 loads a day, they could only do 1. They took a 2/3 pay cut. Most of the drivers were working 12 hours a day or more, while carriers were charging increased shipping rates. None of those rate increases went to driver wages. Many drivers simply quit. However, while the pickup rate for containers severely decreased, they were still being offloaded from the boats, and it's only gotten worse. The experts want to say we can do things like open the ports 24/7, and the problem will be over in a couple of weeks. But getting a container out of the port, as slow and aggravating as it is really the easy part. If you can find a truck and chassis to haul it, but every truck driver in America cannot operate 24/7. Even if the government suspends hours of service regulations, a federal regulation determining how many hours a week we can work or drive, we still need to sleep at some point. There's always something so refreshing when reading an account of somebody who knows the subject about which they write. This is how it looks on the ground to the regular workers, even though they shouldn't be working. But that's not the American worker. He or she will work, even if the pay is low, because there is dignity in work. Legally, truck drivers can work 14 hours a day, which is already excessively long. Most of them are already doing that. There's a limited amount of trucks and qualified drivers in the market, and the solution the government's now proposing is to make them work 24 hours a day, every day, and not stop until the backlog is cleared. It's simply not realistic. And it's physically impossible. If you can't get a container unloaded at a warehouse, having drivers work 24/7, 365 solves nothing. We need tens of thousands more chassis and a much greater capacity in trucking. Many supply chain workers are paid minimum wages. They get no benefits. There's a high rate of turnover because the physical conditions can be brutal. Right now, it's all failing spectacularly together, but fixing one piece won't do anything. It all needs to be fixed, and at the same time. How do you convince truckers to work when their pay is not guaranteed, even to the point where they lose money? The regular person working as a truck driver has a perspective on the trucking crisis that is better than that of any Secretary of Transportation. My prediction is that nothing is going to change and the shipping crisis is only going to get worse. Nobody in the supply chain wants to pay to solve the problem. At this point, the backlogs are so extensive that the backlogs themselves are prompting container companies, ports, warehouses, and trucking companies to charge massive rate increases for doing literally nothing to ease the situation. Given that, the ones operating ports, shipping containers, warehouses, and trucking companies are not willing to pay the workers any more than they did over the last year. The entire industry is basically setting back and cashing in on the huge mess they have created. In fact, the more things are backed up, the more every point of the supply chain cashes in. There is literally no incentive to change, even if it means consumers have to do holiday shopping in July and pay triple for shipping. Now you can see some truth in the comment from Henry Kissinger, who controls the food supply controls the people, who controls the energy can control whole continents, who controls money can control the world. John Kerry, the former senator and 2004 Democratic nominee for president and now Biden's climate czar, said, "Wait until you see 100 million people for whom the entire food production capacity has collapsed." But it will not be climate change that brings about this collapse. It will be the plan of the globalists. Essentially, what's happening is that we've destroyed the supply chain during COVID lockdowns. Now, global fertilizer exports are being destroyed from the Russian-Ukraine conflict. Tucker Carlson has been covering it extensively, and I want to quote a segment of his show here. Tucker Carlson. Wait to hear what's about to happen to fertilizer, which is the basis of food. Turns out Russia doesn't simply supply energy to the entire world. It is a major supplier of every crop nutrient farmers need. That means, thanks to American European sanctions, your grocery bill is about to get much, much bigger. Ben Reinsch is an expert on the subject. He owns and runs the Blue Diamond Farming Company in Iowa. He farms more than 16,000 acres in the state. So again, he would know. Ben Reinsch joins us tonight. Ben, thanks so much for coming on. It's embarrassing how little most people know about fertilizer, where it comes from, what it means. But tell us the implications of these sanctions. Ben Reinsch. Soaring fertilizer prices are likely to bring spiked food prices. If you're upset that gas is up a dollar or two a gallon, wait until your grocery bill is up $1,000 a month. It might not just manifest itself in terms of price. It could be quantity as well. Empty shelf syndrome may just be starting. There you have the perfect globalist plan. Collapse the food production system in some manner, consolidate what remains, then take control over the food supply. I know Tucker and I may see things slightly differently, but even with his cautious approach, he seemed troubled. Tucker Carlson, I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. Up $1,000 a month? Ben Reinsch, sure. The price of growing my crops or the major crops of corn, soybean, wheat, rice, cotton are up 30 to 40. They're on my farm, and most of that is fertilizer. Nitrogen prices are up 3 times from the last crop we put in. Phosphorus and potassium are doubled. The planting season in the Northern Hemisphere is just weeks away. There's no miracle technology that can cut that in half or a third. It's a pretty fixed formula. For me, to grow an acre of corn on my farm, I need 200 pounds of nitrogen, 200 pounds of phosphorus, and 100 pounds of potash. It's going to be hard. How this plays out? Will farmers switch to other crops that produce less? We're certainly not going to literally pour on the groceries to grow this crop. People who are involved in agriculture understand there's a certain way in which food needs to be grown. It may not be as simple as simply telling people to grow more food. Tucker Carlson, I mean, it's only food. Are you saying this is an essential product for people? Ben Reinsch, well, it pretty much is, and there's some pretty likely culprits on this. As you detailed, the number one thing is natural gas. It's the key stock of most fertilizer inputs, especially ammonium fertilizer inputs. But then we got supply chain lows that came from the pandemic. Few hurricanes that knocked down some supply sources. But what's really affecting us is the things that could have been prevented, the ESG things. This could kind of be described as the food crisis of the Green New Deal. To elaborate, policies that have made us more dependent on foreign energy, energy plants that have been decommissioned from other power sources and transitioned to natural gas, and thus competing against the fertilizer input stocks. Wall Street taking an activist investor role with strategic plant closures. But the kingpin in this, the worst part for a farmer, is this action that's been taken by the International Trade Commission, tariffs that they put in place creating monopolies that we can't buy from friendly parties that have a third of the supplies. Henry Kissinger warned us when he said, control the food, control the people, control the energy, control the continents, control the money, control the world. We've already discussed their goal to control energy, people, and countries. Later, we will talk about their strategy in controlling the money. Now let's talk about what Henry Kissinger said first, control the food. Now I have to warn you, this is a bit scary. But of course you can handle it because you want a better world. What's going on? What are the real motivations behind this? Who are the players involved? And of course, most importantly, what are the implications for this, for our own health, and for the future of the country and for the world? They're telling us that realizing the Great Reset is a precursor to sustainable development. They say it's all about the environment. As we discussed in the energy and climate chapter, they've been saying for 50 years that if we don't act fast, the world will end. Many of these elites have gone so far as to say that the world will end in a cataclysmic event if we don't do exactly what they say. As we discussed already, the World Economic Forum has been saying that lockdowns are quietly improving cities around the world. Yes, millions of people are losing their jobs. Supply chains are breaking down. Millions are being pushed into poverty, suicides, drug overdoses. As they say, it's actually improving the planet, right? So the first thing, if you haven't caught on by now, is they want us off of meat. They don't want us eating meat. Why? Why don't they want us eating meat? Is it for our health? Let's dig into that a little bit. As mentioned, Henry Kissinger says that if you can control the food, you can control the people. The globalists say we need to go on a planetary health diet to save the world, as stated in a World Economic Forum article from 2019 with the title, Why We Need to Go on the Planetary Health Diet to Save the World. Here's an excerpt from that article. As the below chart shows, the main change to many Western diets is going to be in the consumption of red meat, cutting back to only 14 grams a day and just 30 calories, which equates to about a mouthful of a typical sirloin steak. Starchy vegetables, including potatoes and cassava, a staple in African countries, are limited to just 50 grams a day, while fish, which is such a big part of Japanese and other Asian diets, is limited to 28 grams. Are we in the West only going to get a single mouthful of red meat a day? It seems that Japan and other Asian countries aren't going to fare much better with 2 mouthfuls of fish. And if you're African, it looks like you'll only get about 3.5 mouthfuls of potato or cassava. In their own words, what's the plan? They tell us. The report says this includes more than doubling the consumption of healthy foods, such as fruits, vegetables, legumes, and nuts, and a greater than 50% reduction in global consumption of less healthy foods, such as added sugars and red meat. The Planetary Health Diet, which involves a shift towards plant-based eating, was designed by 37 experts as part of the EAT Lancet Commission to answer the question of how we're going to feed a projected 10 billion people without destroying the planet by 2050. What do the globalists have against meat? It might be that eating and cooking meat is what made us the brilliant, quarreling humans we are today, as detailed in a 2016 story from Time Magazine, quoting a study from Nature. As a new study in Nature makes clear, not only did processing and eating meat come naturally to humans, it's entirely possible that without an early diet that included generous amounts of animal protein, we wouldn't have even become human, at least not the modern, verbal, intelligent humans we are. According to Harvard University biologist Catherine Zink and Daniel Lieberman, the authors of the Nature paper, proto-humans eating enough root food to stay alive would have had to go through up to 15 million chewing cycles a year. This is where meat stepped and ran and scurried in to save the day. Prey that has been killed and then prepared, either by slicing, pounding, or flaking, provides a much more calories-rich meal with much less chewing than root foods do, boosting nutrient levels overall. If it was meat that fueled our explosive growth in intelligence and ability to problem solve, is it reasonable to ask what would happen to a modern brain deprived of meat? Would we become less intelligent? Some research reported in the BBC for 2020 supports this possibility. Ideally, to test the impact of the vegan diet on the brain, you would take a randomly selected group of people, ask half to stop eating animal products, then see what happens. But there isn't a single study like this. Instead, the only research that comes close involved the reverse. It was conducted on 555 Kenyan school children who were fed one of three different types of soup, one with meat, one with milk, and one with oil, or no soup at all, as a snack over seven school terms. They were tested before and after to see how their intelligence compared. Because of their economic circumstances, the majority of the children were de facto vegetarians at the start of the study. It's not a perfect study, but a pretty good one. The children were de facto vegetarians. Then they were given meat and followed over seven school terms. The results should have us questioning any move toward an exclusively plant-based diet. Surprisingly, the children who were given the soup containing meat each day seemed to have a significant edge. By the end of the study, they outperformed all the other children on a test for nonverbal reasoning. Along with the children who received soup with added oil, they also did best on a test of arithmetic ability. Of course, more research is needed to verify if this effect is real and if it would also apply to adults in affected countries. But it does raise some intriguing questions about whether veganism could be holding some people back. Admittedly, much of this is hypothetical, and while there doesn't seem to be a lot of good data, that doesn't seem to be stopping the globalist war on meat. Why might that be? Meat is likely associated with higher intellectual function. If you're lying to people, it's probably easier if they're not as smart as they might otherwise be. Some evidence suggests veganism is likely associated with lower intellectual function. I believe a planet of vegans would be much easier to control than a planet of meat eaters. Bill Gates has become the largest owner of farmland in the United States and owns over 242,000 acres of farmland. He seems to be following in lockstep with Kissinger. According to latest numbers from 2021, there are approximately 895 million acres of farmland in the United States. Although he is the largest owner of farmland, he still seems to own a relatively small share, less than 1%. If the World Economic Forum says that you will own nothing and be happy, why is Bill Gates so busy buying all the farmland? Could it be that you will own nothing, but they will own everything? An article in Forbes in 2019 explained why money managers were moving into farmland and noted in the introductory paragraph the acquisitions of Bill Gates. Farmland has proven to be an attractive asset class for professional investors with almost uniformly positive returns since the early 1990s. This is because investors can make money from two ways, from the annual cash rent that farmers pay to use the land, and also from steady increases in land values. For example, consider a standard piece of farmland in the Midwest or the South. Assuming an annual cash rent of 4% and land value growth of 6%, the total return would be around 10%. For stable and productive row crop farms, this would be considered normal or even attractive long-term returns in the current environment. On the other end of the spectrum, an almond farm in California may produce an 8% yield, an annual land value growth of 4%, resulting in annualized returns of 12%. It seems like in the real future, the globalists have planned, you'll own nothing. Bill Gates will be your landlord, and he'll be very happy collecting all that rent. I want you to see all of this as part of a plan. Bill Gates and Big Money have stepped into controlling and consolidating the farmland and food supply. The number of independent farms has gone down drastically from 2,166,780 farms in 2000 to 2,012,050 in 2020, a loss of more than 150,000 farms. You may notice that this is the same strategy they've used in their war against businesses during lockdowns. You couldn't shop at the mom-and-pop retailers, but you could go to Target, Walmart, and Costco, or order online from Amazon and put money in the pockets of Jeff Bezos. Whether you believe it was part of a plan or just how things happened during the lockdowns, many small retailers went out of business, leading to record profits among the large retailers, just the sort of people who attend the yearly meetings of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. By thinning the ranks of the competitors, the globalists can much more easily pick off the few remaining survivors. Alarmingly, the food business is controlled by just a handful of large corporations. According to an article from the Greenpeace website, six corporations, Monsanto, DuPont, Dow, Syngenta, Bayer, and BASF, control 75% of the world pesticides market. Factory farms now account for 72% of poultry production, 43% of egg production, and 55% of pork production worldwide. Only four corporations, ADM, Bunge, Cargill, and Dreyfus, control more than 75% of the global grain trade. They overwhelmingly push commodity crops like corn and soy on local farmers at the expense of native farmers. Consolidation makes it easier to control an industry, just as the Rockefeller family did in the 19th century with oil and gas. You see, these billionaires claim to be philanthropists, but at the same old playbook, figure out how to create a monopoly. And if we get rid of the farmers who raise meat products, what will we eat? Bill Gates has a couple ideas. You might want his lab-grown synthetic meat. How appetizing. Here's Bill Gates talking about it in February of 2021. I do think all the rich countries should move to 100% synthetic beef. You can get used to the taste difference, and the claim is they're going to make it taste even better over time. Eventually, the green premium is modest enough that you can sort of change the behavior of people or use regulation to totally shift the demand. So for meat, in the middle-income and above countries, I do think it's possible. But it's one of those ones where, wow, you have to track it every year and see. And the politics are challenging. There are all these bills that say it's basically got to be called basically lab garbage to be sold. They don't want us to use the beef label. Is it just me, or is it a little creepy to have the world's wealthiest man casually talk about changing the behavior of people or using regulation to shift the demand? He seems to believe that those governments, which at the very least want those abominations properly labeled, are just kind of annoying. However, if you don't like his lab-grown synthetic beef, he's got another nifty plan with Jeff Bezos of Amazon and former Vice President Al Gore. Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Al Gore are among the big names backing Nature's Find, a startup developing meatless burgers, dairy-free cheese, chickenless nuggets, and other products using a fermented volcanic microbe derived from Yellowstone National Park. Nature's Find was co-founded in 2012 by Thomas Jonas and Mark Kosabal, originally under the name Sustainable Byproducts. Before co-founding the company, Kosabal had researched a microbe from volcanic hot springs in Yellowstone National Park called Fusarium strain flavolopus. Kosabal and a team of scientists fermented the microbe into a protein-rich substance they called FI, which is now the foundation for their food products. Okay, the world is going to depend on a microbe from a volcanic hot spring for its protein needs. What could possibly go wrong with that? They are now even promoting that we should eat bugs. But don't take my word for it. According to a CNN health headline, the food that can feed and maybe save the planet, bugs, from the article. On a morning in the not-too-distant future, you might toast bread made with cricket flour, drink a protein smoothie made from locust powder, and eat scrambled eggs made extra creamy with the fat from mopane caterpillars with a side of mealworm bacon. That meal will give you 4 times the iron, more than 3 times the protein, and more key vitamins and minerals than the bread, smoothie, eggs, and bacon you eat today, all while saving the planet. This control of food is a classic problem, reaction, and solution. The problem, we need to shift to a plant-based diet. The reaction, we must get rid of all the meat and give you substitutes. The solution, give your lab-grown meats. Lobby governments to enact laws to move people into fake and unhealthy meats. People get sicker. Big pharma makes more money. Oh, and if you get really hungry, you can eat bugs.